sort of differences there are. Is there real damage accruing? So these are special things we can do because we're here on the Isle of Man. And we're very grateful because some of the funds, most of our funds for all the work we do comes from elsewhere. It doesn't come from the island. It comes from the British government via the universities or via the research councils. But we do get a significant amount of money from the Isle of Man government to help us with our fisheries research because they need the information that we can provide. And I'm also pleased to acknowledge that the Isle of Man Bank recently gave us a substantial sum specifically towards our fisheries research because they felt it was so important for the island. Now, the other thing we do on fisheries, I should just mention in passing, is training. This is one of the few places in the British Isles where a student can be trained in fisheries management and fisheries biology. In fact, last year we trained all the Greenpeace fisheries advisors from all over the world here at Port Erin. They all came here to learn what it was all about, to make sure that when they talk about fisheries matters, they actually know what they're talking about. We were very pleased to receive them. Now, all this is about fisheries, but that's not why William Herdman came here. The thing that attracted William Herdman to the Isle of Man was the wonderful shores. And we still do have some wonderful shores. And many of the shores on the island are dominated not by animals, but just as on land, they're dominated by plants. And these plants are sometimes very substantial plants, and of course we know them as seaweeds. So we've done quite a lot of work on seaweeds for many reasons, because they're the main producers. They're the main producers on the shore. But they're also, because they're so big, they are the habitat. The reason there are animals on this shore and the animals that are there are the ones that are there is because of this great dense canopy of plants. It is the plants which determine the habitat for everything else. And there are a weird lot of plants, I can assure you. They're almost every colour of the rainbow. And yet, curiously enough, behind this charade of being red or brown or whatever it is, there beats the heart of a green plant. These are ordinary green plants. If you take away the red pigment, underneath there's a green leaf just like on a tree. So they're ordinary plants with the ordinary pigments. They've got a few more ostentatious ones besides for very special reasons so they can live underwater. They're very weird in many, many ways. Not just in colour. Here's one called Pelvisia, which lives way, way high on the shore. And we found very curiously that when you put it down the shore or you keep it submerged in culture, it drowns. A seaweed that doesn't like the sea. And so we've been studying this because it's very interesting to know why it should be so weird. And by finding out why it doesn't like to be in the sea, we might find out why the other seaweeds do like to be in the sea. And that would be very interesting. Many of the seaweeds are really very interesting. Here is one that's about the size and appearance of a little button mushroom, very tiny little disc. But this is the whole plant. At least it's the whole plant unless it starts to reproduce. Once it reproduces, from the middle here, where this little white area is, it produces two enormous belts, two enormous straps, a meter, 2 meters long. 99% of the plant's weight is in its reproductive organs. Imagine our embarrassment if we had a similar allocation of resources. And where you get a pair of trousers to fit, I really don't know. So these are very... Why should a plant devote that much of its resources just to what... After all, it isn't a plant that swamps every shore. It reproduces perfectly successfully, but not as successfully as you imagine with all the effort that goes into it. So we're interested in why animals and plants allocate the resources to the things they do and how it works, because that determines how successful they might be. And perhaps the most interesting thing about the animals and plants on the shore, and particularly plants, is how they survive the waves. Here is a small winter Vespa. This is actually the marine laboratory here on the left, I might add. This was a storm we had a couple of years ago. Now, it was nice to know the marine laboratory survived the storm, but so did all the animals and plants on the shore. Very few were damaged. Now, of course, the animals are small, they're armor-plated, they can hunker down, but the plants are big. And they're delicate. They're little rubbery things. You know, they get abraded quite easily. How did a plant survive in these conditions? And these storms are just as bad as they look. Because of the density of the water, the effect of a storm wave like this hitting the shore is equivalent to a wind speed of 1,000 miles per hour. 1,000, not 100. That's 13 times stronger than a hurricane. Now, how do they survive? Well, we've been very interested in this, and we've been looking at it from the point of view of the physics. Here we are in the test tank in Liverpool University, which is used for testing ship models and submarines and so on. And what we do is we suspend our seaweeds in this, and we can have pulsating waves, or we can have extremely strong current. This machine, by the way, is enormous. The tunnel alone is about half the size of this room. The whole machine would just about fit into this room. But it does give us a way of translating the performance of these organisms in very difficult conditions into mathematics, into numbers. And really, the interesting thing about this is that if we want to withstand the waves, what do? We get an engineer to design a great big wall, something strong and tough. Seaweeds aren't strong and tough. They can withstand the waves. And if you have a big bed of seaweed, as you do in some areas in California, for example, it acts as a marvelous breakwater. So engineers break the waves as very strong structures. God seems to have thought of doing it in a different way. And perhaps we could teach the engineers something by looking at how these soft structures work in order to make them as a breakwater for the shore to stop the full force of the waves coming ashore. At least that's one possibility. The marine lab at Port Erin were the pioneers of all ecology in shallow waters. And it's still the place in the world you would go if you wanted to look at these sorts of problems, particularly if you want to look at the interactions between organisms, because it's how organisms interact together that determines what the habitat is like, what the environment is like. And I'm thinking here of interactions like competition. Here, for example, one of my students is doing some work. He's removed this sort of seaweed from the shore, and what has happened? The shore's been absolutely swamped with this green seaweed. Now, that wasn't there all the time underneath the other seaweed. It was excluded by the other seaweed. This canopy here dominates the shore and says what can survive there. When it's there, these species can't survive. And it's these sort of adjustments that tell us how the shore works and why it's the way it is and what will happen when pollution strikes it, because it'll change the balance. And a corollary to this is looking at introduced species. Sometimes new species of animals and plants come to Britain, often accidentally, sometimes, as in the case of this one, sargassum, they come as a contaminant on imported oysters. Now, this was introduced into Britain in the early 70s. It is now spread along the entire south coast of Britain, the north coast of France, Holland, many Scandinavian countries. It's now gone down to the Mediterranean. It's now become a common and dominant weed in Europe. And it's a Japanese seaweed. It's not a British seaweed at all. And here is a shore on which 5 years before this photograph was taken, there were two plants of sargassum. Now, everything you can see, all this swirling sort of crochet work, right to the horizon, is sargassum. It's a very aggressive plant. It grows like wildfire. It reproduces like a sailor home on leave. And it displaces many of the other species. And by doing so, it comes to dominate and determine what the shore is like. So we're very interested in introductions, because first of all, we would like to alert the government that something has been introduced and what its repercussions might be. But also, biologists are interested when a new player enters the game, because you see what the strengths and weaknesses are of the other players and how competition works. It's not only competition, of course. Grazers abound on the shore as well. Animals that eat plants and animals eat animals. And early work done in 1947 at Port Erin on Port St. Mary ledges was the first work to show that the most important grazers on the shore are, in fact, limpets. And when you've got a lot of limpets, as you can see, you've got bare rock. Not because seaweeds can't grow there, but because seaweeds are eaten before they ever become visible. Remove those limpets is what we did in 1947, and suddenly a bare shore becomes absolutely swamped with seaweeds because they're allowed to grow. The reason these things like limpets, in fact, most snails, are so effective at removing seaweeds is because they have, instead of a tongue, they have a rasp. And this rasp is all these tips of these teeth, these are all ribbons of teeth, are all tipped with iron and are incredibly strong for scraping the rock. And you can see it's a pretty formidable device. I wouldn't like to be underneath it. I mean, to be fair, this is slightly enlarged. And the interesting thing about this is they're not indiscriminate feeders. They don't necessarily eat everything. Many of these animals are very fussy feeders. Here's the normal common periwinkle pouncing on some sea lettuce, which is its favorite food. But give it some other seaweeds and it will starve to death rather than eat them. Not because they're poisonous, because it doesn't like them. And so we're very interested in the chemistry of what makes foods palatable and what makes foods not very nice. And so that's another thing which we've got quite a good reputation. The chemistry, as it were, of what attracts animals towards particular foods and why they reject other foods. And we haven't done just this sort of work on the shore, we've also done it underwater. The Port Erin Marine Laboratory was the pioneer place in which underwater diving was carried out for biological purposes. Much of the early pioneering work was done here. And in fact, one of my members of staff who retired this year, Joanna Jones, was the first woman in Britain to hold a first-class diving certificate. And even though she's now retired, she still actually goes diving once a week for her work. She's still working. I think we're going to have to club her, I think, before she can, before we can stop her. And the reason, and of course, we don't just dive with aqualungs the way that you would expect to do in shallow water. When we go below about 50 meters, we are using underwater submersibles. I'm sorry it's such a bad photograph. It takes beautiful video photographs, but we, of course, forget to take photographs of it taking photographs, so I haven't got a decent one. This is a little submersible with its own cameras on board, which can be controlled from the surface. You can do all the work in the dry, and it can go as deep as there is ocean. It has no depth limits, only the length of the cable. And the reason, we don't only use this for biological work, by the way. We have used these devices in our diving for surveying the lie of the telephone cable that comes from the mainland to the island. We did that for Max Telecom. We've also looked at wrecks where there's been a mysterious wreck and the boat has gone down quickly. We've been asked to do this to find out what happened to it, what did it snag, and so on. So we do other things apart from just biology, but not very much. We don't want to do much of that. The reason it's marvelous for diving here and the reason it was marvelous for doing marine biology here is because the water's wonderfully clear. And here we are on Bradderhead looking towards the marine laboratory. At least the water's beautifully clean and clear, except where it isn't. And you'll see that this dive is surrounded by bits of floating paper. Now, this is not just loose leaf notebook he's actually been writing on. This is because he's near a sewage outfall. And I'm afraid we do have localized but important pollution problems in the Irish Sea. But almost all the problems in the Irish Sea are actually localized. There are very few widespread problems. And on the island, most of the problems are very localized. And on the island, most of the problems are problems of our own making. One of the major problems is, of course, sewage. Many of our beaches actually fail the EEC requirement for bathing beaches because of sewage. And the government, of course, have recognized this. That's the point of having a scheme like the IRIS scheme, with which we're helping on the environmental side. It is absolutely vital that the island does something about its sewage. Most of our sewage is not treated at present. It must be some. It doesn't matter whether it's the Irish scheme or some other scheme, but something must be done because it is a serious localized problem on the island. And it's not just pollution. Another local pollution problem is metal contamination. You all know that 200 years ago, this was a center of metal mining in Europe, and in those areas where a river goes through a metal area, you do get metal contamination. And the interesting thing is because of the catchment areas and where the rivers go, some rivers are still quite heavily contaminated with metals, and the next one is actually quite clean. But if the river's contaminated, so is the estuary and so is the sea. And we've done quite a bit of work on that in order to give data on what the levels of contamination are. Another thing that's interesting is anti-fouling paints. Most things that are in the sea get fouled by a whole number of things. This is a buoy that's been in the sea, and you can see it's completely obscured by fouling organisms. The way you cure this, of course, is you put poisonous paint on the object, on the hull of your ship. It's a paint that never dries, and it gives out its poison all the time, and it kills off any animal or plant that settles. In recent years, they thought that copper, which was the main poison in these paints, was too poisonous, so they'd use tin instead. Unfortunately, the tin they used was much more poisonous than the copper. And in fact, one of the ways we found out this was some work that we were doing in collaboration with the laboratory at Plymouth, which showed that many marine animals were becoming sterile when they lived close to harbors or close to marinas. And we showed that this was to do with the tin in the antifouling paints. As a result of that work, these antifouling paints containing tin have been banned on all small boats all over the world, in the United States, in Britain, and in here. Of course, some pollutants do come from outside and can cause a problem. And one of them, of course, is oil. An oil spill can occur at any time. And in the past, although oil is quite poisonous and causes a lot of damage, it is the treatment of oil spills that's often caused more damage than the oil itself. And in fact, here is a famous picture of limpet shells on a beach in the south coast of England after they had sprayed dispersants to get rid of the toxic oil. The dispersants were much more toxic than the oil, and they killed every shellfish in sight, including all the limpets. Remember, the limpets eat the seaweeds. So what happened was, where you had a shore like this covered in brown seaweeds, it suddenly became absolutely swamped with green seaweeds, the things that were no longer being eaten by the limpets. Fortunately, in the Marine Lab, we have Britain's leading authority on the effect of oil on shores and the recovery of oil from shores. So again, we're able to give advice and suggest which areas are vulnerable, which ones are robust, and what we should do in case of an oil spill. So perhaps just mention one thing before I pass on. The thing that you never hear talked about, people worry a lot about these various pollutants, but one thing you never hear about is enrichment of the sea. All the time, fertilizers and sewage go into the sea, and it enriches it, just like putting fertilizer on your garden. And in recent years, what's happened is there's been a steady increase. This is phosphate, just a fertilizer, and there's been a steady and very substantial increase over the last couple of decades. This mostly comes from sewage, from fertilizer being put on farmers' fields, and also from some phosphate rock processing in the Irish Sea. But this is not unusual. All the nutrients are climbing like this. The sea is getting more and more over-enriched. It's not a good thing. A little bit of enrichment's good. Too much is very, very bad. And this is happening. And fortunately, we have these long-term data. We've been looking at the sea here on a regular basis, taking regular samples since the turn of the century. And we have long-term measurements of nutrients since about 1950. We have chlorophyll. We have lots of other things. People said, why on earth are you bothering on all these routine measurements? Suddenly, we started hearing about the greenhouse effect, ocean warming. Everyone says, oh, let's have a look at those wonderful measurements you've got. This has suddenly become one of the most important data sets for all the seas around the British Isles. And the government have recognized this and have generously given us some money to be able to keep this monitoring up and to intensify it so that we know more about what the state of the Irish Sea is than we know about most of the seas around the British Isles. And in fact, we're only too pleased to do this work for the government. Also, a few things I should just mention. Perhaps just one thing I mentioned. We're looking at all the time for new techniques for perceiving and monitoring pollution. And one of the problems is, particularly with fish, most animals, if a shore gets contaminated, the animal's there, and you can say, well, if that shore was contaminated, so is the animal. But a thing like a fish swims. So you know where it is when you caught it. You don't know where it was yesterday or last week or last year. Now, in the ear of the fish, they have a little pellet of calcium. And this is greatly enlarged. And these pellets have rings on them like this. And these are laid down yearly like the rings of a tree. So we can count the age of the fish. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We can count how old the fish is by looking at these little pellets from its ear. But what's interesting is now we've started looking at these things under the microscope, we find there aren't just annual rings, but in here, there are probably daily rings. So if you look carefully enough with a powerful enough microscope, you can see the ring laid down yesterday, last week, the week before. And what's more, with a tiny, tiny micro probe, you can analyze the elements in that ring. So you can not only say when it was, you can actually say that during that, on that day, it was swimming through heavy lead pollution. But the previous week, it wasn't there. It was somewhere where it was radioactive. So we actually can trace the pollution history of what the fish was doing, what bodies of water it was in, by looking very, very carefully at these tiny rings in its ear otoliths. This is very pioneer work. We're just doing it. We don't know whether it'll really work yet, but it looks very promising at present, and we've got some money from the research councils to do it. Now, the Irish Sea, of course, gets a terribly bad press. How often have you heard it's the most radioactive sea in the world? It is not the most radioactive sea in the world. It has never been the most radioactive sea in the world. It's never been in the first division of radioactive seas in the world. It is now about exactly the average for radioactivity of all the world's seas. And many of the places with which you go for your holidays have got much more radioactive water than the Irish Sea. There is a substantial amount of radioactive contamination in the Irish Sea, but it's mostly locked up on the Cumbrian coast, and that's a disgrace. But there's very, very little here where you will encounter it. Is it really the Dead Sea? Well, let's let you judge for yourself. Let's just look at some of the inhabitants who live there. Let's talk to the natives and see what they think of it. If you go diving here, you'll come across the kelp forest. This is as dense and as productive a forest as any forest here on Earth. These are big plants. They're seaweeds, but they're like trees. They're so dense you can't swim in from the sides. You have to part them and creep down like a louse in hair. That's how well it is coping with this Dead Sea. Here's a shoal of herring in Port Erin Bay. And the problem here, we don't know whether the fish really are affected by pollution and so on, because fishing is such a catastrophic thing to happen on such a scale to fish that it dwarfs all other adverse effects upon them. So it's very difficult to know whether they're affected adversely by pollution, because fishing is so much more important as a thing to happen to them than pollution would be. So man is the enemy, one way or the other, I'm afraid. Well, he's a very doleful-looking fellow, poor sucker, but he's actually very happy in his quiet way, and his eyesight's at least better than 90% of people in this audience, judging from the number of you that are wearing glasses. So he's doing pretty well in the Irish Sea, and he's very common here. Here's the bloody starfish, Henrycia, and he's doing well here too. You're saying when you climbed up that hill and up the stairs, oh, God, these legs, you know, oh, really rough. The muscles aren't what they used to be. His muscles never, ever get tired. Never. He doesn't even use muscles. He uses hydraulics. And he's got a hearty appetite. If he sees some food, he doesn't just eat it. He throws his stomach completely outside his body and envelops it. Now, it's not pretty, but at least it shows an enthusiasm for life that suggests the sea isn't quite yet dead. Here are some of the beautiful anemones that you find on the seafloor. Again, doing very well. And also these brittle stars. These are starfish with rather willowy brittle arms. And when you go diving off the south of the island, there are whole fields of them, and they sway like, their tentacles sway like grass in the wind. Now, a million years ago, these beds of brittle stars were all over the world, and they were ground down, we think, by predators. And they've remained in very, very few places. And the Isle of Man is one of the places where these enormous beds of brittle stars can still be found. So they've not found any reason to go away from the Isle of Man. Not a very excited young chap. He's smiling in his quiet way. He's a sea squirt. And the interesting thing about the sea squirts, he's one of your ancestors. He doesn't have a spinal column. He doesn't have a vertebral column the way we have. But when he produces his babies, they do. They have a little cord at the back. And it's thought that these babies once got a bit uppity and said, look, there's no reason why I want to go and look like that when I'm grown up. I'd rather look like this. And somehow they didn't convert themselves into the adult. They stayed as babies that became adults but looked the same. And it's thought that this line of the babies from sea squirts had this cord, and they went on to give rise to all the vertebrates, including us. So we started from very humble beginnings, and in the circumstances we've done comparatively well. The interesting thing about the sea squirt here is he's so full of joie de vivre, he changes his brain every week. Well, I'm going to get there with this old brain, I'll get a new one. I've known some people I wish would change their brain occasionally, but he changes it every week. So he's obviously full of beans, and plenty of brain stuff is still available. Here's the lion's mane medusa. Have you ever seen a mane in better condition? No split ends here, you'll notice. He's a murderer, if you know your Sherlock Holmes, but at least he's a healthy murderer. And so he's another one of the inhabitants you will find sometimes very commonly floating at the surface of the sea and washed up on the beach. If you find a coloured jellyfish on the beach, purplish or orangey-brownish, don't touch it. These things can give quite a nasty sting. But that's just their way of saying hi. And here's the best unsolicited testimonial of all. Here he is. He's very laid back. You can see he's yawning. He's actually eating plankton. That's what he likes. And he and about 1,000 of his relatives come to the island every summer for their holidays. So they're obviously not worried about the state of the water around our island. Now, these are sorts of things that we study. We study all these organisms. We're also involved not just in these sort of studies, but also in conservation. We're very interested in conservation on the island, and in particular, you may be hearing more in the next year or so about our plans for the Calf of Man. In many ways, the Calf of Man underwater, you know, it's already, of course, a reserve on land. Underwater, it's a microcosm of all the best habitats on the Isle of Man, and we would like to protect them, and we'd like to prevent divers from collecting anything, prevent scientists from collecting anything. Scientists are the worst thing you could have near to a reserve. And also restrict some of the fishing in the area. That would be ideal. If that can be achieved, then this would be not only a marvelous place to go and see, but also it would be an oasis that was not being destroyed by man. And these oases don't just survive in their own right. Because animals thrive there, they then seed the surrounding areas, and the abundance of life around them tends to increase very markedly. At least that's the experience in many parts of the world. And even the worst sites can be restored. Liverpool had the idea that it would try and jazz up its dock area at Albert Dock. But unfortunately, it had, at Albert Dock, a dock, and the stench was terrible. They asked us what could be done about it. What they did was we dredged out some of the mud, and then we hung in the dock great strings of mussels. And mussels are sort of underwater vacuum cleaners. We filled it up with water, and they sieved all the water every day. And within a year, what you had was absolutely sparkling blue water. So it can be done. It can be done quite naturally. No matter how bad it is, don't give up. Your seas can actually recover. Now, finally, perhaps I should just say that I've given the impression that we work solely around the Isle of Man and in the Irish Sea. It's not true. About half our work is abroad, and I really mean abroad. I don't want to read all these labels, of course, but about a year or two ago, I actually decided we'd put on a map all the projects at that time that were currently running abroad from the lab. And as you can see, there was hardly a place that had a coastline where we didn't have a project. In fact, in the lab at this moment, we have about 12 students, PhD students, from all over the world, from Brazil, from Korea, from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt, from you name it. If it has a coastline, we have or are about to have a student from it. So we have quite a substantial involvement abroad. These vary quite a lot in their magnitude and what we do. We've got a member of staff leaving in a couple of weeks to go to Mauritius, the poor soul. He's going to look at their sewage system, so it is a poor cell. We're going to advise them on how they should treat their sewage. We've been invited by one of Britain's leading engineering companies to be the ecological advisors for the whole new replacement of Hong Kong's main sewage system. We also do get to some very strange places. This is a strange place. This is America, a very strange place. And it was to show you that we do some serious teaching abroad as well as research. This is one of my classes in the United States. It doesn't normally look as bedraggled as this. We'd just won a rowing race and we'd been thrown in the sea as a result of it. Some of the places we go to when we're not in the States are the Yemen. This was the South Yemen a couple of years ago. It's now amalgamated with the North. A very unusual place to go to. Extreme Muslim society, extreme left-wing military dictatorship, and really quite a frightening place to be. When they say drive slow, you drive slow, I tell you. These are the photographs of the Prime Minister and three of his cabinet who were assassinated the week before I arrived. I won't tell you all the horror stories, but it was quite an interesting experience. I was there to see if their marine resources could be harnessed, because it's a very poor country, and they were trying to utilize some of their marine resources. It was a place where we actually used to go on the shore twice a day, once at the middle of the day, because that was when the low tide was and it was unbearably hot, and once in the middle of the night, because that was the other low tide. And here we are in the middle of the night looking on the shore with our hurricane lamp and so on. And the problem was with this, I have never in my whole life seen so many sea snakes. Every single pool on the shore had a sea snake in it. Now, sea snakes are not very big, but they are about four times more poisonous than a cobra, and there's no antidote. And you'd put your hand in a pool, and immediately something would swivel away. And in fact, we'd be out here wading knee-deep or thigh-deep in the waves looking for something, and suddenly something would splash behind you. And the guy would leap up in the air, and he would fall on me, and I would fall on the next guy, and we'd all fall in the sea, and then we'd all jump up like this, because we were absolutely terrified of these darn snakes. So it was a very long few weeks that I spent in the Yemen. When someone wasn't shooting at us or stealing my film and crunching it underfoot because I'd taken a foot off of the wrong thing, I was hiding from sea snakes. These are small and casual arrangements. We do a particular job. But many of our jobs are actually on a much bigger scale. We have link agreements with many universities abroad. This is in the Azores. We have a link agreement with them. And in fact, the summer before last, we took an expedition of 50 people from all over Europe to the Azores because we were asked to survey and advise on the setting up of a huge new marine reserve. And we spent the whole summer there surveying it and doing the work for them. And we have two members of the University of the Azores in my department at the moment, and one of them has his PhD viva next week, so keep your fingers crossed for him. We've also spent 6 years in Mexico. You can see it's pretty tough being a marine biologist. Here we were looking at prawn fisheries and trying to put them on a sound managerial basis. We're just starting a new link program with the University of the Philippines. Here they are opening a new campus in the University of the Philippines. This is me up here taking advantage of the sunshine. And the reason we go there is because they have a marine laboratory on a delightful island, and the government have given them a huge coral reef. Part of it is quite a good coral reef, which is worth preserving, but the other half has been pretty well destroyed by explosives and poisons and so on for fishing. And what we're doing there, you can see here, if you look on the beach, sometimes it's all dead coral because of the explosives. And when you go diving, instead of it looking like a marvelous coral reef, it sometimes looks like someone's backyard. So what we're trying to do there, we have this coral reef, we're trying to find ways of seeding it, of trying to get it faster back to recovery. It's going to be protected from now on, and when they protect things in the Philippines, they protect them. I've never seen so many machine guns, except in the Yemen, of course. And they protect this area, and we are then going to try and get the coral to come back. And that's our job. And it's a very slow job because coral grows very, very slowly. We also have a program, or just finished a program, in Egypt. And this was in Ismailia. And you might think Ismailia, in the middle of the desert, is actually a strange place to have a marine biology project. Here it is. That ship's obviously stranded. No, it's in the Suez Canal, of course. And the interesting thing about the Suez Canal, many of you may know this, here's the canal, but it actually goes through these enormous lakes, the Bitter Lakes, and Lake Timsa. And in these lakes, there are very substantial sea fisheries. And again, we were invited there to try and put the fisheries onto a more substantial managerial basis. We also helped build, or had built, a marine laboratory on the tip of the Sinai, the top of the head of the Red Sea, and trained the staff in marine biology in order to set up a marine setup there. And the reason we chose this area is because it's on the edge of probably the most spectacular coral reef in the world. It goes down as a vertical cliff for 400 meters, and it's just solid coral. And the danger here is it's such a wonderful site, it's tourists that are spoiling it. Diving tourists are damaging the reef. And that was the main job we had there, to think of ways of conserving the reef against the work of tourists. Well, I don't want to go on any longer. I've gone on long enough. If you'd like to know more, I understand there's a very nice exhibition here called The Surrounded Sea, which you're very welcome to go and see. And it's thanks to the generosity of the sponsors of that exhibition, particularly Touche Ross, the accountants on the island, but also the Manx Heritage Foundation, and also the Public Lottery Trust, and also the Royal Society of London, which gave us money and allowed us to try and tell the story of the Irish Sea. So if you're interested in the sea that surrounds you, the environment that determines what it's like to be on an island, then I recommend you go to the exhibition. People sometimes ask me, why did I become a marine biologist? And I always reply, why would anyone want to be anything else? I hope I've given you some sort of inkling of how we've spent our first 100 years here in your company. I hope you think it hasn't been entirely wasted. Thank you very much. Enough's enough.
Yeah. If you've got any problem with that Sargasso seaweed, couldn't you turn the limpets loose on
it? No, they don't like it. We tried, yes. Many of these seaweeds actually contain substantial tannins, compounds which are repellent to snails, and sargassum has quite a lot. Yeah. We've tried other ways of utilizing it too, because of course if you've got a pest, the best thing is to turn it into an asset, you know, but we've tried. But for I don't think it'll reach the Isle of Man. It's a thing that likes warm water. The warmer the water, the faster it grows, the more reproductive it gets. So it probably won't. It's a bit cold for here, I think. We'll get something, don't worry. Well, believe it or not, I have 6 full-time lecturers, that's all. But we do have, because we've been very successful at getting grant, the way that these places work is that you have so much is provided by the main funding from the university. And that pays for the toilet paper, the electricity, and some permanent staff, including technicians. But if you want to do research, what you do is you apply, you say, look, I've got a tremendously good idea, don't you think, to do a particular project. And you go to what are called research councils. And they are they're in London mostly, or in Swindon now, actually, mostly. And they say, yes, a terrific idea, we'll give you the money. Now, none of the money goes into your pocket. It's not for you. The money is to give you another person or persons to help you do the job, or perhaps some equipment. Now, we've been very, very successful at getting this sort of money to do research. At the end of the day, we don't make a profit because all the money is spent on the person that did the research, and all we get out of it is some publications on the scientific results. So there's no profit that a business would understand. I mean, they must think we're crackers. But at the end of the day, we have actually perhaps train someone, but certainly produce some scientific papers. And we are actually very successful. We have one member of staff, for example, the geneticist I told you about. If he was a geology department, in the recent review, he would have been an A-class geology department by himself. He's had that many grants. But that's the way it works. And so I don't know how many people at the Marine Lab at the moment, but in any one time, we would have about 15 or 20 research assistants. We would have perhaps a couple of technicians on grants. We would have visitors from abroad. Every year we have at least one or two Americans, sometimes for a few months, sometimes for a year, to come to work with us. And that, of course, produces results. And so the actual size of the place is considerably bigger than if we stripped down all the grants, everyone would vanish and there'd be a little very small marine biological station again. But it's really mostly on soft money. And that's how science works, I'm afraid. There are very few full-time paid scientists in Britain.
You were talking about, sea snakes and dangerous. Is there anything, dangerous in the Manx waters to your researchers?
The question was there anything dangerous in Manx waters? No, man's the most dangerous thing in Manx waters, really, yeah. There are things in all seas that sting or bite or, I wouldn't like a conger to take a liking to my bottom or anything. But there are very few things in British waters that you could really call dangerous. Even if they gave you a sting, it would be a nasty sting and it might fester for a day or two, but that's it. We're not talking many parts of the world. There are many things that are really dangerous. I mean, fatally dangerous. And sea snakes are quite common in all the tropical seas.
What about stonefish?
We don't have stonefish in British waters. We do have venomous fish. We have weavers and various other things. They do give you a nasty sting. And if you were ill, or you were a baby, or you were, you know, a little frail, then they could be serious. But I don't think I've ever heard of anyone dying from a fish sting in British waters. And although we get dangerous sharks in British waters sometimes, but I've never heard of anyone being taken by a shark in British waters. They get taken in the Mediterranean occasionally, but very occasionally. And there are only two cases of people being eaten by sharks in the Mediterranean in the last sort of 20 years, 25 years.
Mm. So they were eaten. Did you do something then to vary the colour of them?
It's not as easy as that. Yes, they did, I'm sure. The question was about, did we try and vary the colour of the place, try and get them right? It's a long time ago. They did try, but it's hit and miss. They didn't know whether it was diet or whether it was genetics. And when you breed fish, what you do find is that a proportion of the ones that are bred are always abnormally coloured. And it's very difficult to know what to do with them because the public... Oh, I don't like it's blotchy. I don't like the look of that. So you can't even sell it. And it just seems to be something to do with the conditions of culture. Or perhaps in nature, of course, these things are born naturally, but of course they're snapped up early. But clearly the work wasn't right in the early days, and they never got it right, no. I mean, it was got right subsequently, but I don't think it was a problem they had in the 1960s work. It was only much earlier they had this problem. Curious. I didn't say we knew all the answers. But we know quite a few of the questions now.
Well, what a splendid ending to our series of lectures Professor Norton has given us this evening. Hasn't he shown us what an enthusiast for his subject he is? And I'm sure that the way he has communicated this to us tonight must be a very, very great asset to all of the students at the centre. The most useful thing, I think, in any scientific study is a love and an enthusiasm for that, pardon me, and this Professor Norton has in abundance. And I'm sure his lecture this evening has opened many people's eyes, mine own included, to the breadth of the work which is being done at Port Erin. I think it is a failing of the Manx that we are far too inclined to put ourselves down, to not appreciate what an important place the Isle of Man is. I had always considered that Peel was the centre of Western civilization, but I see that when it comes to marine biology, we have to give way to Port St. Mary, to Port Erin. to Port Erin, yeah. Now, I was only thinking earlier, what made me say that, I think that slip of the tongue, I was thinking of the song, I'm the pride of Port Lamurra, I can reap and plough a furrow and so on. I can't help thinking that Professor Norton has a good claim to being the pride of Port Erin. Now, the exhibition which Professor Norton arranged, The Surrounded Sea, was originally to be in our temporary exhibition gallery until the 25th of May. But there seems to be quite a chance that it may be extended for a little while at least after that. So do please, if you haven't already seen it, come back fired with enthusiasm from tonight's lecture and have a look at it. And if you enjoy it, please tell your friends and encourage them to come too. We hope very much that you have enjoyed this series of lectures. If you have, again, may I say, go out, spread the word, tell your friends. Get them to come and help us to make the next series as successful as this one has been. When the exhibition leaves here, it will in fact be going to Liverpool. And we're very pleased to have in our audience tonight Mr. John Edmondson, who will be responsible for the exhibition when it gets there. You're most welcome, sir. So it only remains for me to thank all our lecturers, all the staff who have helped in many technical ways in making them a success, and thank all you, ladies and gentlemen, for having given us such great support throughout the year, and we do hope that that will continue into the future. Thank you very much indeed.